Hey guys, welcome to the Cracked Podcast, which is the podcast for the website cracked.com. I'm Jack O'Brien. I am the editor-in-chief of Cracked and the host of this podcast. Not coincidentally, I hired myself. If you're not familiar, Cracked is the website that grew out of the carcass of Cracked Magazine, the old poor man's version of Mad Magazine. We're nothing like either of those magazines. These days we write nonfiction comedy articles about the most interesting ideas and facts that we can get our brains around. We have a new book out this week called The D-Text Book, which is a fully illustrated, full-color textbook. Kind of goes through all the myths that you learned in school and debunks them. That's one of the things we do. It's a good book. Go check it out. And on today's podcast, I am talking to our most popular writer, my executive editor, Jason Pargin, who writes on the site as David Wong. We're going to be looking at an extremely specific blueprint that most of our favorite movies and stories are sort of built around. Whether you realize it or not, and I didn't for most of my life, possibly because I'm stupid, but the vast majority of the movies that I love have the same exact rhythm, and it's something that we all sort of secretly expect our movies to follow. So, I mean, this makes more sense in the context of music, right? Mathematically, there are an infinite combination of notes and rhythms at which you could play any musical note, but there are only like a handful of chord progressions that our brains will recognize as music, and that's the same specific handful of patterns and chord progressions across any Western country or most cultures in West and South Africa. There have been like thousands, millions of blues songs written, and the vast majority have the same exact chord progression. This is why we complain that songs and genres we don't like all sound the same. We're not wrong. They are mostly the same. They have the same basic skeletal structure and rhythmic and tonal DNA. And then the songs in our genres, we can kind of appreciate the tiny nuances and subtle differences and the textures and all that good stuff that they choose when building a song around these mostly identical structures. And we kind of all intuitively know this about music, but for most of my life, at least, I wasn't aware that most of the movies I've ever loved, no matter what the genre, have the same sort of narrative chord progression, a standard skeletal structure that all of these movies are built around, no matter what genre. I didn't even know that our minds worked like that, to be honest. That you could pay attention to rhythms and beats that take 2 hours to play out. If you slowed down my favorite song so it was 2 hours long, I'd imagine it would sound like total nonsense to me. There's no way I would notice if one of the beats came a minute too late. But that's exactly what we find with movies. If a two-hour movie gets to the first big action sequence 2 minutes too late, I will leave the movie thinking, oh, well, that dragged a little bit at the beginning, without realizing why. It's like there's a part of your brain you don't have access to that is secretly watching every movie with a stopwatch just to make sure it hits all the right beats at the right times. So that's what I'm going to be talking about on today's podcast with David Wong. The weird ways in which all our favorite movies have the same exact rhythm, whether we realize it or not. And we're also going to move on to talk about how that story structure can sometimes bleed into reality, how we process the real world and remember stories. At that point, Jason makes one of my favorite points anyone's ever made on this podcast. Listen for it when we start talking about American wars. All right, here is my conversation with Jason. Talking to Jason Pargin, aka David Wong, who is the executive editor of Cracked.com.
Yeah, and for people who aren't familiar with Cracked, basically Jack is sort of like the Axl Rose of our Guns N' Roses. Almost and then I would be like the Matt Sorum, who was that chubby drummer they brought in later.
It's a very self-effacing comparison. We're going to be talking today about story structure in movies. Every movie can be laid over this really specific grid where there's like a midpoint where everything changes. There are these three acts in which
the same general thing happens in each one of them?
Yeah, and the thing is, if you go to the average movie-watching person, most of them know, like if you tell them, well, every movie, and I say every movie, I mean every Hollywood big movie, follows the same structure, they generally already know that, well, yeah, you've got to have the beginning where you meet the characters, then they go on some sort of adventure or have a conflict, and then there's a big climax at the end where they fight the main bad guy, or in a romantic comedy where they finally get together, being chases her through the airport. They know that in general there's this sameness to the way these movies play out. What most people don't realize, unless you've tried to sit down and write a screenplay or had a writing class, is that it is down to the minute when each thing has to happen. And that if you were to write a movie, like if studio executive flips open your screenplay to page 60 or to page 20, even if they do not know what your movie is about at all, they expect to see something, a specific thing on that page. If they flip open, it's a 120-page screenplay, if they flip open to page 60 and it's just a couple of characters having a boring conversation, it goes in the trash. Because they're reading a screenplay by somebody who doesn't know what they're doing. It's not following this very specific template.
Right. It's not that this template was put in place so that studio executives could lazily skip around. It's because these are the rules that movies have been following for ages, and they've been following them for a reason, right?
Yeah. And I'll run through some examples. For instance, the catalyst. This is the scene, the event that starts the adventure. That needs to happen between pages 10 and 15 of the screenplay, or 10 to 15 minutes into the movie. For people who don't know, the way the script formats work, each page is 1 minute of movie.
And this is a 120-minute movie, right?
Yeah, a screenplay, you should shoot for 120 minutes. There's some variation because you can have it longer or shorter at the end, but that's the general format. Like, if you give somebody a 300-page screenplay, again, they know you're just a crazy person. You don't know what you're doing. So, for instance, in Star Wars, Luke meets the droids at this point, 15 minutes in. Because when he meets the droids, obviously R2-D2 has the hologram on there. That's what gets him embroiled on the big adventure. He's now connected to the main story with Darth Vader and all that. Then there needs to be a big event between pages 20 and page 30 that changes the main character on a personal level. So in Star Wars, at 30 minutes in, exactly, Luke meets Obi-Wan Kenobi, gets his lightsaber, realizes he's a Jedi, and so on. So that first thing was him connecting to the main story. The second one is the personal thing. And then what you talked about, at 60 minutes into the movie, is a scene that in the screenwriting world they call it the point of no return. This is either a big emotional moment, like a character dying, or it's the biggest action scene in the movie, maybe second biggest next to the climax, but usually it's the action scene that's just shown in the trailer. And so, for instance, there's almost like a party trick you can do where you can go to Netflix or wherever you watch movies and just, with your mouse, just click over to the 60-minute mark, any mainstream like Hollywood-type movie, and you will see either a big key emotional moment, again, somebody dying, whatever, or you'll see a car chase, you'll see something exploding. So just to rattle off some examples, at 60 minutes into Star Wars, and I mean at exactly 60:00, the Millennium Falcon lands on the Death Star. This is now the heroes, they're now confronting, you know, they're in the enemy headquarters, this sets off the whole rescue of Princess Leia and all that. In Raiders of the Lost Ark, they find the chamber where the Ark is at exactly 60:00. If you remember the scene, they're like on that hilltop digging for the hatch, and there's like a silhouette, and Indy's walking around up there. And then they're digging, and then finally somebody says, like, Indy, here it is. And lightning crashes behind Indy. He turns around and then looks down, and with their hands, they scrape the sand aside, and there's this hatch with, like, etchings on it saying, here's the Ark. The lightning crashes at exactly 60:00.
It's like an egg timer. It's like you're setting an egg timer, and you're just like, okay, and here comes the part where something big's going to happen. Indy, here it is. And then you're like, oh, okay.
Correct.
They're going to find you.
In Die Hard, John McClane says his yippee-ki-yay catchphrase at 59 minutes, 55 seconds. Now, you're saying, like, what, the catchphrase is the key moment? No, that moment comes during this tense phone conversation with Hans Gruber. He gets on the phone with the villain for the first time. It's the same with Luke and the guys landing on the Death Star. This is the moment where the heroes meet the villain. And again, if this is the scene they call the point of no return. Like, it's now personal between him and this guy.
Right. If you think about the first half of Die Hard, which I was surprised that this is the whole first half, but it's all Bruce Willis hiding. You know, he's running around hiding and then killing terrorists when they come to him, but he stays. He doesn't taunt them. That all happens in the second half, and that's when it starts, right at the exact midpoint.
Exactly. In The Dark Knight, Chris Nolan movies are a little bit different, but in The Dark Knight, Commissioner Gordon gets shot at 61 minutes in. And then, not to spoil a recent movie, I'll keep this vague, but in the movie Gravity, the Sandra Bullock, George Clooney, a space movie.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
60 minutes is when the space vampires show up. And that's the scene. Watch for the Dennis Rodman cameo.
Yeah.
He appears on screen at exactly 60 minutes.
The twin Rodmans, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Rodman clones show up. Jaws is the only movie I've ever seen, in case you haven't been listening to past podcasts. I explained that I had watched that movie like 120 times by the time I was 5 years old. It's very similar to Die Hard. It's the attack on the beach. So the first half of Jaws is all Brody trying to convince the mayor that a shark is actually attacking people. And that's the mission of the movie, is can I convince this guy to shut down the beaches because there's a dangerous shark out there? And then with all the news helicopters there and the whole world watching, on the most crowded day of the summer, the shark just eats people and attacks, almost kills Brody's son. And so from that point on, it becomes the Jaws you know. It's almost like that's where the movie kind of restarts. It resets with the version, that higher stakes version of the plot that you know. This is now a movie where a supernatural shark needs to be stopped. Otherwise, it's just going to eat everyone. And in Alien, were you going to mention Alien?
No.
Because the midpoint of Alien, I'm almost positive, is the chestburster.
Yeah, and that would make sense. This is one of those things where once you notice that every action movie now is colored blue and orange in the tones of every scene, once you notice it, it becomes interesting when you see different movies try to conform to that where maybe it wasn't ideal. Like, if you've seen Mission Impossible 4, what's the one thing you remember from the ads for that movie? Like, what's the one image they really sold that movie with?
Dust storm?
Well, it was, for me, it was Tom Cruise climbing on the side of that giant tower in Dubai for some reason.
Yeah, that's probably right.
The publicity photos and stuff for that. That movie, at that scene, they had hit the 60-minute mark, but the story is a very tense. They're just trying to do this operation where they're trying to slip these nuclear launch codes to somebody. Like, they're trying to fake some documents. It's a very quiet, kind of low-key scene that, like, the show Mission Impossible used to be all about. It's all about the lie and the disguise and all this. But they had hit that 60-minute mark without the big moment. So suddenly it's like, you know what? We've got to get down to the server room. But damn it, the only way to get to that room, for some reason, is if Tom Cruise straps on a harness and dangles from the side of this building a mile above the surface and precariously, using suction cup gloves, climbs down the glass and then has to laser cut his way into that room. That stunt was inserted to give them the big moment at the 60-minute mark, because otherwise, if characters are sitting in a room talking.
Yeah.
In The Matrix, when they hit the 60-minute mark, it's just, if during this kind of lull where Neo is simply training with Morpheus, he's taking him through the various simulations, explaining, there's a lot of exposition. But exactly 60 minutes, exactly, this alarm sounds. They're inside one of the simulations, and an alarm sounds. And he's like, what is it? They're like, come to the cockpit. then Morpheus runs up there, and suddenly the ship is being chased by those sentinels, the squid-like robots.
Right.
And there's this exciting chase, and finally they have to, like, fly and dodge through this tunnel and then hide in this cave, and the things, you know, go by, and they're like, oh, okay, they're gone. That's done. But in order to break up, because as an audience, you're expecting some sort of noise or explosion here or big revelation. And for instance, we had already gotten the big revelation that, you know, the Matrix is a false world, blah, blah, blah. So they didn't have that to spend anymore. So what they needed instead was an action scene, and they weren't in a situation where they were outside of the Matrix where all the action occurs. So they had to interject this thing in there. This chase scene that was ultimately inconsequential. They didn't lose anything. It was just they introduced that those robots existed.
It's almost like they know that they need to get our heart rate up a little bit or else they'll lose us. It's almost like an EKG monitor. They're like, okay, this part, we need to get them a little bit excited again or else we're going to lose them. They're going to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, and I don't want anybody listening to this to think that I'm sitting here acting like I've broken the Da Vinci Code of film. If you take a screenwriting course, if you buy a screenwriting book, if you've had a screenwriting class in college, they'll go over all of this. For people working in Hollywood, this is second nature. They're not sitting there like, oh gosh, you know, we need something at 60 minutes. It's like, hey, I'm not seeing the tentpole scene. I'm not seeing the midpoint. What did you intend for that? Or this is coming too late or whatever.
See, I wish you had told me that earlier, because this room that I'm recording this in looks like the room in A Beautiful Mind. It's just movie plots and pictures of movie scenes with just like thread connecting different moments and stuff. But yeah, it's commonly known and it can make you feel a little bit cynical. On the other hand, you know when not to get up and go to the bathroom during a movie. You know that something important is going to hit right at this point.
And I will say this, too. If the stuff doesn't arrive on schedule, it's not that anybody's going to walk out of the theater and say, you know what, the script, the structure of that was all wrong. Or that was what people will say is the movie was slow. Or it dragged. Whenever you hear someone using those words, they mean that something didn't arrive on time. And they weren't aware of it, but you can feel it. Just like you're driving up to a green light, you can feel that it's been green for a long time and it's eventually good. Even if you've never been at that intersection in your life, you know there are red lights coming. You can just sort of sense it. It's been green too long. Where it's the same thing. It's like I've been sitting here too long to not have seen something explode. Even if it's only off by, like, 5 minutes. For instance, to grab another example, the one criticism I'd heard of The Avengers, a movie that was almost universally loved or at least not hated by most people, was that the way people always phrase it is it dragged a little bit in the beginning, but the rest of it is awesome. But this is an example, one of the examples, where everything that I'm talking about kind of arrives late. The midpoint stuff in that movie, and it's because you've got a bunch of characters that they're trying to introduce and trying to establish a lot of things. But the way he has it all come together is that at 62 minutes in is when Black Widow walks into the room with Loki. They've got him imprisoned on the flying aircraft carrier, right?
Right.
And they begin this verbal confrontation. At 65 minutes... the characters realize that Nick Fury and S.H.I.E.L.D. have been sort of going behind their back and they wanted to use this stuff for this Tesseract technology for weapons. And then at 68 minutes is when the bad guys show up and attack the helicarrier and blow it up. And then the Hulk runs wild and all that. So that stuff all starts to happen more around the 70-minute mark. That feels like it came late. And sure enough, if you look at, like, the DVD extras and see some of the stuff they cut with Captain America trying to adjust to life in the modern world and all this stuff, you look at that and a lot of people will say, well, why did they cut that? That's, you know, this is supposed to be Captain America's movie. Why did they cut that character stuff? And the producers would say, oh, well, it's for length. You know, we cut for length. And a lot of people would say, well, why couldn't you have cut elsewhere? Why couldn't you have cut some of the stuff from the end? Or what difference does it make if a movie is 2 hours and 10 minutes versus 220? And what they're saying is it would be pushing that 60-minute scene back even later than it already is. Mm-hmm. And so that's becomes huge because a large part of what makes it into the movie and what doesn't is based on this time template that, I'm sorry, this has to go, this character scene has to go, not because it's not effective, not because the audiences won't care, but because it ruins this very precise paint-by-numbers structure that every movie has to have.
Right. There's an impulse when you first hear this to think, oh, well, this makes it so much easier to make movies, or it must make it so much easier. But it's actually kind of hard, right, to fit everything in. And there are rules that you're trying to tell the story and be original and artistic, and then like you just have to casually hit these signposts that everybody expects and without knowing that they expect it.
It depends on how much you care about the story. Because on one hand, you're right. You sit down and write a story. If you're just writing a novel, or if anybody listening to this, like we just gave you pen and paper and we said, hey, sit down and write a story. You're going to think through, okay, what would this character do now? This character, you know, his best friend has been murdered. You know, he thinks this gangster's done it. What would he do next? When you're writing a screenplay, if you've sort of been hired to flap out a Fast and Furious sequel, like in a weekend, you're not thinking, what's this character going to do next? You're thinking, okay, we've reached page 20, so who's going to die here? Which death is going to be the thing that changes the character on a personal level? Okay, we've hit page 60, so what's the big, you know, this is where we'll do the big car chase or whatever. And for instance, the movie Speed, the original one, they had famously shot several stunt sequences before they had written a script for it.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, and they had brought in writers to, like, tie these together. Mission Impossible 2 was also made this way. They had storyboarded a motorcycle chase and a jet ski chase or what. I haven't seen the movie. And then they brought in screenwriters later to, like, glue this all together. So that guy is starting with, okay, this motorcycle chase will be our 60-minute crazy action scene. This stealth mission, this will be near the end. It has to, maybe this is the enemy compound he's wandering into, and so on. And then you sort of piece that together based on the timestamps for it. The movie Kung Fu Panda, Jack Black plays a panda bear that can do kung fu. Dan Harmon had been brought in to do some script doctoring on that. He had famously blogged about how they had brought him in having already animated a bunch of sequences, but they're like, okay, now we need to know where these go. Write something that kind of makes these connect. It's, on some sense, it's easier because it's the story's already written for you, because so many of these things have to happen on schedule. But trying to tie them together in a way that makes sense or that's like true to the characters is what separates the great movies from the bad ones, because trying to keep the characters, like their motivation, intact so that it makes sense what they're doing, while also perfectly conforming to this template, takes a really talented writer. You've got to really know what you're doing. And it's not easy, but every movie you've seen where it didn't make sense, or like the character suddenly fell in love and there's no build up to it, there's no reason for it, you have to understand that's because they were due to fall in love at, you know, whatever, page 90. And so that's it. That's why it had to happen. Not because of something these people would do if they were really in that situation, but because a movie has to have a certain shape. And if it doesn't, you won't like it. You won't know that's why you didn't like it, but it will feel like you'll say, yeah, it didn't make sense, or it was kind of slow or whatever, but that's what you really are feeling, because you've seen thousands of movies that all follow the same rhythm. And so if you tune into the Independent Film Channel or something like that and watch a bunch of indie films where they've tried to be experimental, or where it's just characters hanging out for 2 hours, there may be some interesting scenes, but halfway through it, you find yourself picking up a magazine and reading it while the movie plays in the background, because it doesn't have the specific rhythm that, over decades, they have figured out this is the recipe that grabs and holds people. And I don't know, it's kind of a chicken or the egg type thing. Is this the rhythm of a story that the human mind needs? That this is the way we need a package in order for our minds to be engaged, or have we simply been trained from childhood to not care about a story unless it takes a specific shape, and I actually don't know.
Right. You mentioned earlier the blue and orange thing, and I wanted to circle back because that would be one way to view this, right? This is a convention that movies have adopted because other movies did it that were successful, and it just kind of builds on itself. And there could be some other way to write movies that just hasn't been explored because everyone's too afraid to go outside of the box. You know, the blue and orange thing, we pointed out in an article and on the site a few years back that when you look at every action movie that was coming out that year, they were tinted blue and orange. If you just looked at them, like blurred your eyes a little bit and looked at them, you would see a blur of blue and orange from most shots in most action movies, right?
Yeah, and it's down to, it's hard to understand unless you see it, but if you Google it, you'll find people have assembled a collage of posters. So like on the poster, the skin tones will be tinted really vibrant orangish color, and there'll be orange fire behind them somewhere, but they'll be wearing blue. The text of the title of the movie will be in blue. If you go watch the trailer for Pacific Rim, go watch the trailer for the Hunger Games sequel that's coming out called Catching Fire. It's basically a two-color affair. The trailer for Ender's Game, the movie is coming out in a few days of the recording of this call. Same thing. Ender's uniform is blue. The background is blue. The floor is blue. The walls are blue. The ship is blue. The exploding alien ships are orange. Skin tones are orange. If they're eating food, it'll be some sort of meat that's sort of orangish. It'll have carrots on the plate. The set design, costume design, the effects, everything is either extreme one color, extreme the other. And this is simply because they found that those two colors, when contrasted with each other, are pleasant to look at. It's a vibrant contrast. They're at opposite sides of the color wheel of the rainbow or whatever. And so it just makes those colors make each other pop. And so over time, the fear of creating a scene or a visual that was something less than pleasing to the eye has made everyone afraid of using anything but these two colors. And so it's a little bit the same here, where it's like, yeah, technically we could get very experimental and switch things around, but when you've got $200 million sunk into the production of the movie and another $100 million in promotion, is now really the time that we want to play with just, okay, let's go to a four-act structure instead. Let's just completely turn everything on its head. And there's just not, this works very, very well. It's what the audience has been trained to want. So,
yeah, why not?
This is what you give them.
Yeah, I feel like the blue-orange thing, obviously we know there are great movies that weren't tinted blue and orange because Star Wars came out before this was the rule for all action-adventure movies. Everything that came out in the 80s, basically. But the story structure thing feels different to me, first of all, because it's been true for every movie that I can watch and consider great. And also, you always hear stories about people making these great movies that everybody loves, like Star Wars and Jaws, where on the set, they thought it was going to be a piece of shit. Nobody was taking it that seriously. And you said something earlier. You said, it depends on how much you care about the story you're telling, right? And if you really deeply care about the story you're telling, it's going to be hard to hit all those different beats. You're not just cynically tossing story beats up against this pre-existing paint-by-numbers template that you know is pleasing to people. You're telling your story about your guy Luke, who is exactly like you, and you're trying to get at the truth of this character, as opposed to just a lot of these classic movies are someone adapting someone else's screenplay or adapting. Godfather is a novel that already existed. They just laid it over this story structure. It almost seems like the movies are improved by people not feeling like they're telling their story, being super impassioned. And that's really cynical, but it also sort of makes sense, you know? The number one complaint about Hollywood is, why can't they tell original stories? Why are they always adapting something else? And it's because at least partially, you don't gain much from having this impassioned original character that you care about and who comes alive in your head. You're just kind of hitting these story beats, laying other people's characters out across this pre-existing grid, and then just making creative decisions within that grid.
Right, and I mean, I've been through this because
right.
I wrote a novel. It got turned into a movie. You know, it was a horror novel that was 500 pages long, and then, as we just mentioned, the screenplay is going to be 120 pages. And then horror movies are short. There's no such thing as a two and a half hour horror movie. You would get too tired of watching it. It's same thing with comedies. The really long comedies feel long. So going into it, to this day, as much as people like the movie, the complaints about everything that was cut are relentless from the first day. People always want me to complain about it, like, oh, they've cut literally half the story. But from day one, I know enough about movie structure. My proposal of how to structure the movie was far more brutal in what it cut than what the final outcome was. Because I knew that it's not a matter of trying. If you just try to cram a book into a movie, and anybody who has seen and hated the Harry Potter movies can attest, because those movies follow the novels like scene by scene and have horrible structure as a result. I knew that the difference between making this into a good movie versus something that's just a movie version of the book was night and day, because the movie has to have structure. In the novel, a novel does not. A novel can be whatever the hell you want. Like, that's, there are some novels that follow that structure, especially if the author wrote it hoping it would become a movie. But there's absolutely no rule for a novel, like, okay, now page 270, you've got to have the flashback to his dead wife. Like, no, that's the difference. So you have a novel that was written in no way with a movie in mind, and then now it has to become a movie. So that's such a different thing, that the writing of that script was a very, very long process, because on top of trying to make the structure work out, remember, you're also trying to figure out what can actually be shot.
Right.
And, you know, and what's possible and what isn't and that sort of thing. So all this is where the outcome of a movie, and I think Jaws is a great example, is almost entirely built upon your limitations. Jaws has the style Jaws has purely because their mechanical shark looked like crap. It looked like crap on camera.
Right.
Everything about the style of that movie and the tension and the way, you know, not showing the shark and cutting to the shark's point of view were all things a desperate, harried Steven Spielberg was in the editing bay desperately trying to cut around the fact that they had a crappy fake shark, and that every shot with the shark in it made it look like a B-movie. But the difference between what he shot and the Sci-Fi Channel original Sharknado was that you had a genius there taking those limitations and creating something that was actually brand new. So it's the exact same thing when you're trying to work around story structure. If you've got somebody who really knows what they're doing, they can play with that in infinite ways. It's just that what they cannot really do is deviate from it much and expect to have millions of people like the movie. Again, if you're just making something for yourself that's going to be a little indie thing that people maybe will watch on cable, then, you know, if it's just something you and your friends shot on a weekend, then go for it. But if you've got something that is intended to be seen by a lot of people paying money to see it, you know, every step of the way has to be with everything arriving right on schedule. And this is true even when if it's, like, based on a true story. If you're doing a Nelson Mandela biopic, by God, it's 60 minutes in. You've got to figure out which moment from his life is going to serve as your point of no return.
Right.
15 minutes in, if he did not actually suffer a tragedy that changed him personally as a youth, by God, you've got to invent one between page 15 and page 20 because you want people to watch the movie.
Right. I feel like Great Gatsby is an example of a novel that I don't think Fitzgerald wrote that with a movie in mind, probably. And people keep trying to adapt it. And I think, first of all, it takes someone who really loves that novel to want to adapt that. And there's a sense, I think, in which really caring about the original. I think The Watchmen was sort of an example of this in the sense that it was kind of a mess. And wasn't there a criticism of that, that it was too loyal to the graphic novel in certain places?
Yeah. And it creates something that's, for that type of movie, that's too long and that doesn't feel right. There's also that middle ground where you have a director who thought he was being really faithful to the original, but in my opinion, maybe didn't understand the original.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. Whereas when you have a genius working with a novel like Jaws, where the novel Jaws, the shark has a speaking role. He comes out of the water and he speaks with a southern accent, I think. And no, but the original script had a lot of close-ups on the shark, and the shark did a lot of facial expressions or whatever. I don't know what they had in mind that was so different from the final one, but yeah, halfway into that production, they were like, oh, Jesus, we should maybe think about just cutting our losses right now, because this movie that is about a shark can't show the shark. We're kind of fucked. And turns out they weren't. So you talked about Nelson Mandela briefly there, and I just want to talk about Nelson Mandela for the rest of this podcast. Now, I want to talk about this idea that this bias towards telling stories, or knowing that people want to hear stories in a certain format, could bleed into reality. You know, we talked about it a little bit briefly, but to catch people up, we were talking about the Prince quasi-biopic Purple Rain, in which they graft a story arc onto his life where he's abused by his father. And you pointed out that his father is actually a great jazz musician who had co-writing credits on Prince's music up through Bat Dance, which is weird that he chose that as his final song, the culmination of their writing together. So there's this way where the news or documentaries even have to follow these same story arcs. Once Jaws was a hit, suddenly the local news was covering lots of shark attacks, even though more people are killed by cows falling on top of them while they're milking them than shark attacks. The news wanted to get some of that sweet, sweet shark fear story that people were going to the movies to see. And I used to work in the news. One of my first jobs was working for a 60 Minutes-like show that wasn't 60 Minutes. And the executive producer was, it was a known thing that he loved CSI and wanted each story to have a CSI element to it, where, you know, we zoomed in and saw something under a black light, and that had something to do with how this crime was solved. And this is even though these are true stories that we're working with, mostly about, you know, that have nothing to do with looking at semen stains under a black light. But that was what was hot on TV at that moment. And so there was a pressure to move things in that direction. And you've written about this before on the site. You've written about how to spot bullshit news story about politics. Do you see any similarities between the type of bullshit stories that we tell ourselves are true in the news and in documentaries and in school even, and these story structure rules?
Well, you and I come from the same world. My first job out of college, I was a journalism major, and I worked as a producer at an ABC affiliate. It was not as fancy as the job you had, but again, that's why you're the Axl Rose of our band, and I'm the drummer who replaced Steve Adler because he had a drug problem. But the issue is that it sounds stupid to say, well, because we watch, you know, the kids these days, they get their heads full of movies, so this is what they want to see in real life. It's not that. You've got to understand the basic story structure, the three-act structure, the adventure structure of you're a normal guy, something disrupts your life, you have to go confront that thing, and then finally at the end you confront it, defeat it, and learn something about yourself. That structure predates the written word. There are plays in ancient Greece that had that structure, the three-act structure. There are stories that our great-great ancestors told around the fire 200,000 years ago that had that structure. because it was something calculated that if you've got somebody sitting on an uncomfortable log in front of a fire, and if you want them to not fall asleep, this is the shape the story has to be in. This is written, this is etched into our brains. And so for thousands of years, that's basic story structure. And that rhythm of problem solving, you're a farm boy on an alien planet, you know, an incident stumbles your way, you make the choice to go pursue it, you're severed from your home due to your parents dying or whatever, you go to a strange place, you confront the problem, you overcome your fears, and then at the end you've defeated the problem but have returned home, you know, a better person. That story was told to children and grandchildren from generation to generation in one shape or another since before we developed language, you know, or written language. The oldest scrolls, the oldest whatever, had that story structure in it. So it is a very basic part of human culture to expect problems to follow this arc. And when they don't, we get super disappointed. So like in the world of news, when we go fight a war, the news reports it very much according to, damn it, America was sitting here minding its own business, and then Pearl Harbor was attacked. There was nothing that preceded that whatsoever. It was just America, we were sitting here minding our own business, and the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. That started World War II. So then our young boys had to venture off over to Europe and to the Pacific and to fight. And then finally at the end, there was the final battle with Hitler or whatever. And we beat him, and there was a new world after that. And then we came home and it was over. That's why we love that war so much. Because the way the propaganda sold it, I say propaganda, I mean just literally the way the news, like the military, the government issued newsreel sold it was, according to the Luke Skywalker story, with America being the Luke Skywalker, Hitler being Darth Vader. It follows that structure very neatly. If instead we go into a war and we're minding our own business and then something happens, but it's not totally clear why it should have led to war, and then we go fight the war, and instead of having like the big climax, it turns out that it's just, we're just sort of meandering around fighting for several years, and it sort of peters out. Eventually, we just kind of get bored and stop paying attention to it.
Right.
The Korean War, when they went on, they just stopped covering it after a while. That war, it just lost America's interest very quickly because we were still coming off World War II, and we expected, okay, we're going to go fight the final boss of Korea, and then it'll be awesome, and then we will have Korea will be like the 51st state. Is that how it works? And then instead, it was like two straight years of negotiating over the 38th parallel and where the border would be drawn and, you know, negotiating and does the Chinese involve. And we just got bored with it because it didn't follow that arc. It, you know, it didn't have that next thing. And so you sort of kind of see the same thing with modern wars where there's not like a beginning, middle, and end. There's a beginning, the middle, and then we just sort of, it sort of goes until slowly we just, the troops just sort of slowly start coming home, and there's not this big final end boss thing. It just sort of peters out. And sure enough, the popularity plummets and people's enthusiasm plummets, and you don't get that satisfaction because you've been trained to want things to play out a certain way. And I am convinced, I cannot back this up with any science,
the Pearl Harbor never happened.
I am convinced that people in their personal lives expect that same rhythm and that they're continually disappointed. I'm not going to claim that depression comes from this because there's chemical reasons, things like that. But I believe that the people I meet, the reason they're continually surprised by the way things play out is because they expected, let me give an example. Part of the template I didn't discuss before is that about 75% of the way through the movie, you have to have the low point. Usually it's around between page 80 or 90, depends on how long the movie is. But this is like in Star Wars, it's Obi-Wan Kenobi dying. In The Avengers, it's Agent Coulson dying or appearing to die. in Die Hard, it's when John McClane, remember, he walks on the glass, his feet get all cut up, and he calls the cop and tells him to say goodbye to his wife and all that.
Yeah, basically leaves a suicide note.
Not to spoil Gravity again, but just in vague terms, this is the scene where Sandra Bullock's character gets explosive diarrhea, and it fills up her spacesuit, and she literally drowns on her own feces.
Right.
But the whole reason that is in the movie, obviously, is to then set up the triumphant third act. You have the all-time low point, everyone's sad, oh, Gandalf has died, everyone's sad, but that's okay because we're going to rally and come back and it's exciting. And that low point makes the climax more exciting. Very obvious. Like, this is, you could figure this out. But in your real life, when you hit that low point, I think there's a natural inclination to think, oh, okay, this is just the lull before the dawn, the darkest before the dawn. This is where, yeah, my company closed and I'm out of work, but something will come along. Something will come along right about now, because in every story you've ever seen, this is where, you know, even the ones based on a true story, even the ones, even the biopics, you know, if it's a biopic about a musician, this is the point where the drugs almost derail him, where, you know, he gets, you know, into some sort of a lull before he finally beats it and comes back stronger than ever.
Real quick, I want to jump in here with an example of a documentary, actually, that is an example of this. So the really popular recent one, Searching for Sugar Man, was about this guy who was this somewhat lauded musician in the 60s. His life had fallen apart. He was now, you know, working construction in Detroit, just a total nobody, down on his luck. And he finds out that, wait, he's still hugely famous in South Africa. So they've turned this guy's life into, when you least expect it, when you're down on your luck and like think that your whole music career, this thing that gave you reason for being, was a total waste, you come to find out, whoa, there's a whole country that loves you and thinks you're famous. Well, so the thing that the movie cuts out is that he was also hugely famous in Australia that whole time and knew it and knew the whole time that he was massive in Australia. He had toured in Australia in the 80s. So he was familiar with the idea that his work was appreciated elsewhere in another country. So then he's just a guy who's big in another country, finding out that he's really big in yet another foreign country. And so that doesn't have this low point, this moment of utter hopelessness that we need our movies to have right before the uplifting climax. So they actually changed the true story. And I think people see these Oscar-nominated, I don't know if it won, but I think it was nominated movies, documentaries, and assume, okay, well, that is a true story. That's a true story that I can reference in my mind as how the world can possibly work. But no, it's just people who tell stories and who create the culture around us, knowing that we demand our culture fit into this very specific shape.
Yeah, and if anyone is scoffing at the idea that, oh yeah, like I really expect my life to turn out like Star Wars, let me give you an example I bet you have seen. Because this structure, it's not just action movies, right? Like, we've referenced a lot of action movies because that's what we've seen. But, it, you know, romantic comedies work the exact same way. You know, at halfway point, there's some big moment between them that changes the relationship. Well, in a romantic comedy or romantic movie, the low point is, of course, the false separation 80 or 90 minutes in, where the man decides, you know what, I'm going to go pursue my career. I'm going to leave the city, pursue my career instead of my relationship with Jennifer Aniston. And, you know, all is lost, and they decide to separate. And then, obviously, that's to set up at the end where the guy, like, goes and chases her through the airport and changes his mind. How many guys or girls have you seen go through that really dark point of the relationship and cannot convince themselves that that reconciliation is not coming? That 5 years later, we'll still be convinced that the guy and or girl will come chase them through the proverbial airport because, well, but we were meant to be together. It's like they've been trained their whole lives that this part where it appears that they're not meant to be together, this is really just setting them up for when they truly do get together and then everything is wonderful. And trying to get used to that last part not happening It's very difficult in many cases, depending on the person and depending on their maturity level. And also, in the course of, I almost hesitate to bring this up, but in the course of talking about that story structure and how many things follow it, I have to bring this up because there are many, many listeners right now shouting at their headphones, what about the Bible? Because obviously the entire Gospels begins with Jesus appears to be a common child or whatever, and then he finally, you know, starts pursuing his life as the Savior, and then he's killed the darkest part right before the dawn, and then he rises and everything's fine again. In the book of Revelation, the world itself has been destroyed and evil runs rampant, but that's okay because at the very, very end, God comes back and fixes everything. So not bringing that up, like, see, here's yet another example of a false story that has been fictionalized, Christians.
Where's your God now, listener?
Yeah, it's yet another screenplay written by a hack writer. Not meaning that, but meaning even that, as far as the DNA of the story that's etched into our minds, either God wrote that story to conform to our story structure, or the people who wrote down those events wrote the story to conform to the story structure, or the universe itself conforms to that story structure. But one way or the other, it sure as hell does, and there are writings that predate the Bible that also do. So that's how far down the rabbit hole that goes. So when I say you expect the world to conform to this, I'm not trying to, like, you know, the kids today don't know the difference between movies and real life. Because that structure and that story structure goes way, way deeper than Transformers 3. That's something that is kind of embedded in every story we tell each other. And in fact, let's just say if you, Jack, were to be brutally assaulted today.
Sure.
And go to the hospital. When you're telling that story a year from now at a bar, you will make that story conform to, you'll start out, yeah, I was just walking home, I had my own business, guy came out, assaulted me in various gruesome ways. You're going to make it conform to, I was minding my own business, the adventure started, I was assaulted horribly, and then everything turned out fine, and I'm back to normal. Like, you're still going to package it, instinctively package it that way, because we don't know any other way. You're not going to get it down to the minute, but you're going to have still that vague shape of the story that eventually arrives at a certain point. And we all know people who don't know how to tell stories.
Right, it just seems kind of aimless, and they're not telling the right parts at the right time. And you can hear it. You can almost hear it. You're like, where is this going? There's no structure, right?
Yeah, these are the people like, ah, I was walking home from work the other day, and somebody calls my name, and I turned around, and it turned out they were talking to somebody else.
Right.
You're like sitting there waiting for the rest of the climax. They thought you would, you know, you're their friend and you would like to hear about their day, whether it was interesting or not. But at least people like me, I'm sitting there waiting for, like, I turned around and I found a treasure map to the Holy Grail.
Right.
And then me and some friends went and tried to find it, and we did. And then the Nazis took it.
Yeah, the version of the story of my parents meeting and getting married, in my head, I was just realizing, as you were kind of outlining the structure of romantic comedies, the version of that story that me and, you know, my sisters know, the version that's in my mind has all the beats of a romantic comedy where things seem hopeless and there's miscommunication. I might have made most of that stuff up. The true stories that we tell ourselves, or the way we imagine things happening, matches these story beats. I think that can be problematic. You mentioned the idea of someone who goes through a terrible breakup and keeps expecting the person to come running through the airport to save them. I think another place I've seen it is people who are in bad relationships who stick with them because they, you know, every romantic comedy makes it seem like dating is really hard. There's constant miscommunication, and you will accidentally get the impression that they're sleeping with someone else. I think there's a tendency for people to expect dating to be harder than it is, And then marriage is happily ever after. That's the finish line of most movies. Whereas in reality, dating is, if you're dating the person who's your soulmate, is going to be like the most fun you've ever had. You're not going to spend a ton of time fighting with each other or having miscommunications. And if you're in a relationship where, like, you guys are constantly mad at each other and estranged from one another, that might look like a romantic comedy, but it's probably the sign of a terrible relationship that would not get better after marriage, right?
Yeah, and how, you know, now Sandra Bullock and Hugh Grant have an understanding, and so that's it, that's fixed. They overcame their one conflict, and so now it's over. They're going to move in together and share a
checking account. Can't believe you avoided Gravity spoilers all this time and then told everybody how Gravity ends right there. Camouflage chameleon, ninja skill in your building. No time to grab the gun, they already got your wife and children. A hit was sent from the president to raid your residence because you had secret evidence and documents on how they... All right, that was my conversation with Jason Pargin. Hope you enjoyed it. That idea that World War II has the same story structure as Star Wars was like my favorite thing ever. I, on the other hand, said some pretty cynical-sounding things there about movies being better the less the creator cares about them. Obviously, that's not true unless the creator is a genius with a very specific voice and vision. You can not care about your movie so hard that you end up making Snow Dogs or something terrible. All right, footnotes! This week, I wanted to pick a few songs that I loved a ton before I had any clue that anyone else did. So we closed out with the song Fourth Chamber off the Genius / GZA solo album Liquid Swords, and particularly the RZA's just insane verse about having your wife and children kidnapped by a government hit squad. I hope that's not based on a true story, the RZA. That was probably my favorite verse off of any Wu-Tang Clan album. When I was a teenager, something you should know about me, I had the poster of every Wu-Tang solo album up on my bedroom and dorm room wall, despite the fact that I lived in Kentucky and then a prep school in Massachusetts where most people hadn't heard any of those albums and thought it was hilarious that I liked them. But that album and that song and verse in particular were always my favorites, and I recently found out that they're like everyone's favorite. They just re-released the album on the 20th anniversary, I guess, and Pitchfork gave it a 10, and the writer, I think, talked about how everyone wants to do the RZA's verse on Fourth Chamber at karaoke, and it made me feel weirdly proud, I guess, because, I don't know, I feel like that's what a lot of music is, and dancing, and being a music fan is sort of celebrating these patterns that we share on some primal level that we don't actually have access to and we can't control, but they make us move in the same way. So there's that mutual recognition of, yes, this is good. So music, you guys, right? But I do think that gives us context in which the paint-by-numbers blueprint of movie scripts and storytelling doesn't have to feel cynical, right? It shows our limits as human beings, but it also shows that there are these shared, unspoken similarities in the way we see the world or want to see the world, or, you know, you and I might have completely different favorite movies and your favorite movie might make me think you're kind of stupid, but we both need those movies to have the same bones and we're both sort of secretly nodding along to the same story beats before they even happen. All right, back to the footnotes. We started out with the song Dance Yourself Clean by LCD Sound System. Sort of stumbled across that on Pandora, having never heard an LCD Sound System song before, and it immediately made me think, yes, that is what music should sound like when it's being made by white people. And just now when I told our producers, Jen and Brett, that I was going to open with that and found out they both really liked it, again, weird pride. And I guess that's why I spend 5 minutes recommending songs at the end of every podcast, because I feel proud of stupid things. All right, that's this week's episode. Next week, I have some of our favorite writers on to rewrite the endings of some of our favorite movies and TV shows. For instance, what if Forrest Gump was secretly Kaiser Soze-ing all those people on the bench and pulling like all the details of his stories off of like the People magazine the nurse lady was holding or like a nearby newsstand? Your head would explode, that's what if.
And there's more where that came from. It's not all alternate endings to Forrest Gump. That's next week's episode on the Cracked Podcast. We will see you then.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio. Boom.com. The wolf dead.